And we're back. We were just having a conversation before the Tim Foundation. We were talking Foundation. Let's just dive right into it and share it with the listeners. Your issues with Foundation second season, which I have not started yet. I've been slammed. I was on vacation and, you know, the film week and all this stuff we're talking about today. So I have not had time to delve into Foundation second season. Does it improve on the sloggy mess that was the first season?
I believe it retracts itself. It reconnects itself to the foundational material, if you will. So we're walking through a story that's more familiar, particularly, you know, those of us who read those, you know, books from way back in the day, that's more familiar. And, you know, we were just talking about it all. The principal problem that I really had with Foundation really just had to do with just the kind of language that they use in the show, because it's very present. It's very contemporary to the present moment. And we were joking about it a little bit. Look, when I hear a character say, "Hey man," you know, or something like, "Yeah, I can't," you know, you can't do that. And so I have a problem with that. But now that it's sort of pointed itself back at the story, the building of the foundation, the foundation, I'm not going to ruin it for anybody, but you know, the building of the second foundation is where we are now. And this is a story that I'm familiar with, so I like it better. That language thing is just a thing that sort of drives me crazy. The other thing that we started talking about, I was telling you, and you were telling me that you had to turn it off. I started listening to while watching shows that voice for the hearing impaired. I said, you know, and it started with turning on the subtitles or with everything. I just turn on the subtitles with everything now. You know, I just have the subtitles on. I go, I do what I'm doing. I can read it from across the room. This mostly owes to the insanely inconsistent mixing of programs, broadcast television, every streaming service, DVDs. The mix of any given thing that you're watching is just outlandish. And you just have no idea what the gain will be on any given moment of broadcasting or watching. Watching that you do. It's just terrible to my mind. It's just absolutely awful. Even using some of the technology that we have to sort of level out, you know, the audio. I'm sorry, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So I took to simply turning the audio down and turning on subtitles. And now I've taken to turning on that automated voice, that voice for the hearing impaired. And you were telling me why you don't like it. I want you to make sure you tell everybody that. But I got to tell you, I enjoy it.
I've been doing it not on television, but I've been doing it with articles, right? Like if I'm sitting in the car and there's an article and it's not a podcast or anything. So I kind of want to hear that Substack. So, you know, cause I follow a lot of stuff on Substack. So I'll hit that little button at the top of the Substack that reads it to you. And it's in this, I feel like it's across, like I'm a Stepford person and Hal 9000 is reading me the news and it's very creepy. And I did it for like 2 days and I said, I can't do this anymore. This is just way too it's way too AI.
It's wonky in the reading area. That's kind of strange too, because you know that stuff has been around a while. Now that AI is starting to do it, I think it's going to get better. For listening to it while watching, you know, whatever it is that you're watching, streaming, whatever it is, it's sort of interesting. Yes, you can still sort of hear that synthetic quality to it. Man. It does change from program to program. You know, I'm watching Foundation. That's why we started talking about Foundation. There's this voice, you know, and then I switch over. I'm watching Shrinking, which I think is Apple Plus.
Yeah.
And it's this other, it's like this weird little female voice that's doing and it's just, it's very, very strange.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the voice is always a little bit ahead of the action. As I thought about it, I don't know. Maybe it's just a timing thing because I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, why would the voice? This is meant for the visually impaired, obviously. Yeah. So I'm wondering why the voice would need to be ahead of the action.
Great question.
But I don't know. It's an interesting thing, but it's something that I've taken to doing. For one thing, it allows you to just get up and go do whatever the hell you want, and until our car chase starts, you don't need to be there.
I really do value that increasingly. A little bit of news. So Warren Pereira, who made the documentary Tiger 24, which have covered on this podcast. We interviewed him on this podcast, and we covered the movie on Film Week. We've kind of, really given him the red carpet treatment. Tiger 24 is now on Netflix.
Yeah.
Anybody who hadn't caught up with it before, you got your Netflix subscription, go watch it. It's a great doc by a fantastic filmmaker who we really, really support and consider a good friend. Let's talk obits here a little bit, because got a whole bunch of them. I'll just lay them all out in one. Paul Reubens, Bo Goldman, and William Friedkin. That's the big, gnarly trio that we lost. And Robbie Robertson, of course, as well. Not a film person, but a great musical talent who's been covered in movies like
Indians Who Rock. Waltz and Indians Who Rocked. Man. It was so weird. Paul Reubens. So for one thing, Paul Reubens, Pee Wee Herman, Paul Reubens. When that was announced, it caught me by surprise. The cancer. What surprised me most is that Paul was 70, a little bit older, a little bit past 70. I don't know why. Maybe it's because of that Pee Wee persona. But Paul was always sort of in my head in that tiny little suit somewhere around 38, 39. No matter what.
See, as for me, for you, he's in that little suit. For me, he's in that little adult theater in Florida getting arrested.
That whole situation. Paul had a moment. One of the things, I was a big fan of Paul Reubens in his work and in his development of that character, Pee Wee Herman. I did not know that Paul Reubens had been on The Gong Show, The Gong Show that you and I grew up on, using in the middle 70s. Plus 60 times, more than 60 times on The Gong. And I watched The Gong Show, late 70s, whatever it is. I just had no idea.
Again, it's like going back and revisiting the electric company and going, oh, that's Morgan Freeman. What's he doing on the electric? I didn't know he was. Yeah,
nice soft shoe there he's got. Yeah.
So, and it's like, I mean, this happens to me all the time where I'll go back and I'll revisit a movie. Like it happened to me after Mad Men had its run. I was watching, as I do every Christmas season, I'll watch Love Actually. Love Actually. And then it gets to the end and I go, oh, that's January Jones. She was nobody at the time.
Just one of those things. Yeah. So anyway, it's a thing.
Paul, I did see him, a couple of times doing Nightmare Before Christmas live, recreating his original character in that. And he did wonderful work for Tim Burton. And he left a good, solid legacy. Pee-wee's a hell of a character.
Well, that TV show, I think you and I were chatting, Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah.
Everybody remembers Lawrence Fishburne, cowboy, whoever he was, Bob or whatever he was. Everybody remembers him. But I had forgotten that Jimmy Smits came through that show. Yeah. I had forgotten that S and Patha Murchison, Law and Order and all those, homicides or whatever, these big heavy dramas, came through that show. I had forgotten all of those people came to that show, and Pee-wee reached out and tapped all of those folks personally. Get me some Lawrence Fishburne, get me some Jimmy Smits, because he knew that their range was much deeper and wider than what we had suspected, because he had seen them do all of these things before.
And Pee-wee's Big Adventure is a very odd movie that lingers. I mean, it started Tim Burton's career. Mm. It took a TV character and gave it a big screen persona, a big screen profile in a way that almost never happens. Mm. And it's got some really priceless moments. I mean, the Large March moment is still one of the funniest things I think I've ever seen on screen. It's all there. Bo Goldman. Let's talk about Bo Goldman for a second. One of the great writers of all time. No relation to William Goldman, but a legendary screenwriter in his own right. Melvin and Howard, kind of the one that we always point to, but many other great screenplays as well.
Oh yeah, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and But I'm like you though. I'm those little quiet. He's one of those working screenwriters from that early television age who when drama was the thing. Right. Realism was the thing, right? So he wasn't writing car chases. He wasn't writing anything to do with aliens. He wasn't writing. This was all. These were human stories and drama. So you get movies like Shoot the Moon. You know, it was just about a marriage falling apart.
Yeah,
you know, which was weighty enough to have a full size film, and you get the Flamingo Kid, man, movies like that that are just about people and dramatic Scent of a Woman. That kind of stuff.
Well, a great writer, if you're an aspiring writer, get hold of his screenplays and read the screenplays. Don't just watch the movies, read the screenplays, read how he wrote dialogue, how he constructed scenes. Wrap your head around it. It's wonderful to use him as a benchmark. Really is. Man, Friedkin, what can we say? This guy came on like a firestorm in the 1970s, along with all the other 70s filmmakers. You know, we can throw in Coppola and Scorsese and Spielberg and Lucas and De Palma and all of them who kind of came out of maybe the late 60s a little bit, but they really kind of defined the 70s. But Friedkin did it in, George Roy Hill, probably another one, but Friedkin of that whole film brat generation is the guy who seems to be associated with the brattiest of it. French Connection was just was not your grandparents' cop movie. It was not the crime film that people had come to expect. It was, in many respects, it kind of has one foot in the blaxploitation genre a little bit. It's sort of there across 10th Street a little bit. But it's gritty in a different way too. It goes to Europe, and it's got, something that is kind of hard to put your finger on. And The Exorcist was the same thing. It was not Rosemary's Baby. It was not, the previous generation of horror films. It was something new and creepy and really just, it was all, you felt Friedkin's personality in these movies. You felt his anxieties. And what can we say that defined him for that generation?
Well, look, I'm a film school guy. You're a film school guy. I love film schools. William Friedkin did not go to film school. William Friedkin was a dude who went to a war and he had jobs and he had life. And he came up through documentary filmmaking, and had to learn all of the stuff. He knew how to string a Niagara. He knew how to thread that 16mm Airy. He knew all of that, and all of that you see that style, that verite you see in every film that you just mentioned. The French Connection. He didn't know how to make films, quote unquote, in the way that Ford and all these people also didn't go to film school, by the way. But all of these folks who were trained in the traditions of the studio system, he didn't know how to do any of that, so he didn't try.
That's a great point. And I think the movie, the most underrated film of his that they have to revisit, is To Live and Die in L.A.
To Live and Die in L.A. Again, you watch that movie, it's like you're watching a documentary. The Sorcerer, which is, but you watch it, the tension comes from the fact that you feel like you're involved in the thing. Because, again, he brings the immediacy of that sense of verite, And I got to tell you, he didn't lose it. It's not like he lost it. The films changed.
Yeah.
But he never really changed,
No, he didn't.
He was making real. Killer Joe is a nasty little, little number. That's only 10 years ago or so, and that's a nasty little number that lives in the present day. So there you go.
Well, let's jump into some movies. I'm going to blow through some. We got a lot of great Asian titles here. Have not done a segment on Asian titles in a while, so I want to blow through some stuff that's really great. Korean film Project Wolf Hunting. These are all titles I'm going to go through right now from Wellgo. Project Wolf Hunting is basically kind of a diehard on a ship, bunch of prisoners, jailbreak on a ship thing, and they take over the ship. But it does this Korean thing, because Koreans love to mix up genres. They love to turn one thing into another thing. And with the last voyage of the Demeter tanking right now, mentioning this, that also on this ship is I had to review this for Film Week too, is basically a zombie dude experiment, like a crazy Frankenstein-y guy down in the hold, and once he gets loose, it's just roundabout mayhem. Doesn't really make sense. It's kind of a ridiculous movie on many, many levels, but it's deeply entertaining. You're never bored. You roll your eyes a lot, but then it'll throw you a curveball and you're never ever bored.
Yeah.
The Tank, another, and gosh, these titles. No, really, it's just so the I don't even know how to sum this one up. It's in English, first of all, if that assuages anybody. It's English language. And I'm not entirely sure what the backstory is on this, but this is about some people. Oh boy. I'll give the whole thing away if I get too far into it. All right. It is about a family who inherits a certain property, and there are family secrets associated with it, and those secrets emerge in deeply troubling and frustrating ways. So it's a little bit like I don't want to call it a haunted house story. It's a thriller. It's a thriller about mysteries. And it's called The Tank, and The Tank is not a military tank. It's like a hidden tank, a water tank. So, give it a look. It's in the classic kind of Welgo vein.
About 10, 12 years ago, maybe less. That's Scott Walker film. And Scott made this film with John Cusack and Nicolas Cage. When you get Nick Cage and John you together, and I think it was called The Frozen or something like that. And it was loosely based on this true story set in Alaska. And it's just interesting the way these folks' careers go. That's about 10 years ago, which might be the last time Scott knocked one of those things out. But he wrote it and adapted it. Vanessa Huggins was in it. I remember that. She was really young. And that was a really, really good movie, The Frozen. But it was one of those ones just kind of came and went. It was John Cusack and Nicolas Cage. Funny, the stuff that sticks in your head.
Wow.
Just for that's no reason whatsoever.
Totally. We got an utterly bizarre Korean film here called Alienoid. Again, Koreans love to mix up genres, so I'm going to do my best to explain what this is. So you got a couple of people from a previous Korean dynasty like 1,000 years ago, who they're like, you know, shamanic mystery men, and they magically, or maybe not so magically, transport themselves to the future, where they suddenly run into the problem of a people who are like fighting a crazed alien that is basically like the alien, almost like the robot in the new Lost in Space.
Oh yeah.
So, it's fighting aliens. It's time travel. It's people from 1,000 years ago. It's people in the future. It's all of this stuff wrapped up in a story, which is beautifully, beautifully made.
Oh yeah.
But do not think about it for a single solitary second, because the plot will unravel like a moth-eaten sweater.
It's good. I'm sorry. The good looking movies they make.
They make really good looking movies.
Full of a lot of good looking people too.
Yeah,
I must say. And you know, and some of that stuff. And they make these movies for $1.95, but they look like they spent some bucks on them.
Yep, it's for true. They get great production value out of this stuff. Absolutely top notch production value. And then we have another Korean film called Night of the Assassin, which is just a straight up kind of. It's a facsimile of a feudal Japanese samurai film, like a Ronin film, Lone Samurai kind of thing, except it's set in the same facsimile of Korean history. So it's a period Korean feudal action thriller. You get swordsmen and you get oppressed villagers and all the usual stuff. It's basically a Ronin movie. It's basically a Kurosawa film, but it's a lot of fun. It's really well done. Night of the Assassin, A Final Mission. And then a bunch of these on a new series of them. They're all Hiya originals. These are all movies that you can see on Hiya, which is the streaming platform for Asian and martial arts and action films. And these are all from that deal. So these are all Hiya originals. Starts with Fist of the Condor, which is pretty great. I thoroughly enjoy this. This is, you know, it's... I mean, it's all martial arts. It's all takes place in the wake of the fall of the Inca Empire, 16th century, and they just use that as a backdrop to invent a new martial art and have a whole lot of fighting scenes. But it's pretty great, you know. The guy who stars in it, Marco Zaror, whom you've seen in the last John Wick film and a few others, great fighter. So it's super cool that he gets his own thing. I think he's Hungarian or something like that.
Yeah, big guy.
Yeah, man, big, strong.
That chin. Got one of those chins.
Got a young Ip Man movie here, as if we haven't had enough Ip Man movies. This has absolutely nothing to do with Ip Man's actual life story. This is just another one. This is trading on the title Ip Man. Throw it in, you know, throw that and some Wing Chun in there and you're good to go. Probably one of the weaker Ip Man movies, but it's still got some decent fight stuff in it. You know, does again, they get it, has a number of scenes that justify it. Mm. The Grandmaster of Kung Fu is a whole lot of fun. This is a mainland Chinese film, but it has that Hong Kong style before it. And of course, they have to tie it in with Ip Man here. The tagline on the back is before Ip Man. Before Ip Man. Now we're before. We've exhausted Ip Man's life, right? But now we're going before Ip Man. There was Master Huo. All right. Doesn't have quite the same ring to it. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of, as with a lot of Chinese films, a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment here.
Yeah.
And, you know, they the Japanese are the bad people here. It's going to be that way for a while.
The non-king thing, man.
It's what it is. Anyway, so yeah, you know, it's Qing Dynasty fighting the Japanese and lots of great martial arts stuff. We also have The Legend of Gattatkaka. And I don't want to emphasize the kaka. I'm sorry, but that's what this is called. The Legend of Gattatkaka. Gattatkaka. A Hero Awakens. You know, it's a martial arts thing. It's a superhero thing. It's a little bit of Doctor Strange. It's a lot of the mystical martial arts stuff that we've seen before. There's an English language track in here, which you might want to take advantage of, because otherwise none of this stuff will make sense. but yeah, it's got its moments. It's got its moments. You know, they're doing superhero stuff a little bit differently elsewhere in the world. Mm. And then the last one here from the Welgo Well is Code of the Assassins. So this is another medieval swordplay thing, but it's more of the epic war. It's not in the samurai vein. It's in the vein of those period Chinese films, which are all about battling warlords and armies, and they're oftentimes Mongols. And this one, you know, it's about a young assassin who is caught in the middle of all of this this intrigue and these palatial plots. And again, you know, it gets a little convoluted. All of the various interlocking, interacting parties and their cross purposes. But it's very well done. Production value is through the roof. And you wonder, why can't all Hollywood films have that kind of consistent production value? Also got some DVDs here from Film Movement, two of them also from Korea. One is a horror film called Sire, S-E-I-R-E, from Park Kang. This played at the Fantasia Film Festival. It is like all Korean horror, really, really chilling. It's a ghost story. And it gave me absolutely the willies. Very, very effective mood. Not on Blu-ray, only on DVD. And then another lovely film called Aloners. And this is a drama. And it's a really, really lovely Korean film. It comes with a great short film on it, too, called The Moths Will Eat Them Up. You know, this is kind of a... It's a workplace movie, which is usually a French thing. And we got another one of those that we're going to talk about a little bit later. Movies about jobs and the workplace, the stresses of employment. That's not really a Hollywood thing. We don't make those kinds of movies.
Not anymore. You got to go back to, Blue Collar, maybe Sadly Filled with Martin Ritt.
Yeah,
exactly. Martin Ritt might have did Stanley and Iris, something like that. Not for 50 years, 40 years, yeah.
So that's partly what this is. This woman, she works at a call center. You know, she does, she just lives on the phone all day long. And she now has to train a new employee. And it's about friendship. It's about work. It's about all of these things that are kind of a microcosm of issues in Korean society. It's really, really, and you know, how people do feel alone and they feel isolated because of the modern world. So Aloners, it's a nice little film. And then we've got a Thai movie called Cracked, which is Thai horror. It's a ghost story. Thai movies freak me out a little bit too. They do. Because they always go to some weird village witchcraft thing. You know, there's always something about somebody who lives in a little hut somewhere in the mountains in the rain, and they've got a pot and they put weird, put bats in the pot, and then ghosts come alive and start eating people. So there's all kinds of weird stuff going on with ancient stuff. Anyway, this has some shots. I'm not even going to say some scenes. This has some shots that will just make you scream. Absolutely scream. Very, very effective. So anyway, it's called Cracked, and don't watch it with your family. Just telling you that. Getting down here. Oh, I'm going to put a couple of the rest of the Japanese stuff on hold. Let me just go through the Hong Kong stuff real fast. Cause it's really great. So, from Arrow, got a lot of great stuff from Arrow, but first a couple of standalones. Hand of Death is an all time classic. Comes with Mandarin and English lossless on it, plus Cantonese stereo. This is a 1976 Golden Harvest release. And it was not like a huge success at the time. It's a kind of a Shaolin Temple story, but man, it does have some great fighting in it. Really great stuff. Same thing for Warriors 2, which features Casanova Wong and Sammo Hung. Anything with Sammo is worth watching. This is also a this was Sammo Hung's directing debut, by the way. So you see, he's a great director in his own right, better than Jackie Chan in many respects, I think. And then some great box sets, the Brave Archer collection. These are wonderful, wonderful movies. There are five of them on here. The Brave Archer, The Brave Archer 2, Brave Archer 3, The Brave Archer and His Mate, and Little Dragon Maiden. These are absolutely terrific wuxia stories. It's a wonderful saga. All the stories are great. All five films are top-notch. They've got a feature-length documentary on here as well and audio commentaries, and it's all great stuff. It's a wonderful education in this film series, but in the wuxia genre in particular.
I love the box covers for every single one of those. It's just great. Beautiful graphic designs, so much energy and action. It's fabulous.
And Academy Award winner Michelle Yeoh anchors the In the Line of Duty films, all four of them. Comes with a booklet as well. This is from the Fortune Star collection, and this is just an absolutely wonderful collection of films. You got to check these out if you can find them. I think this is increasing. This is from 88 the 88 films library via Fortune Star. Anyway, the In the Line of Duty films are terrific. Cynthia Rothrock's in here as well. You know, anything with Cynthia and Michelle is absolutely to die for. It's fantastic. One of my all-time favorites, Zoo Warriors from the Magic Mountain. This was directed by Choi Hawk. There's been another Zoo Warriors since, which he was also involved in. The original, there's nothing like it. Absolutely fantastic. This is from Shout Factory, and it's one of the all-time great Hong Kong New Wave era wuxia films. Yun Bu, one of the three brothers with Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung, is the star. He's a deserter, and there's, you know, ancient vampires in the mountains, and it's just a riot. It's absolutely a lot of fun. The fighting, the comedy, the whole thing is fantastic. Donnie Yen, a very young Donnie Yen, is all these people are in hot movies now. Donnie Yen, of course, the blind guy in the last John Wick. One of his earlier films is Tiger Cage, which has been bootlegged forever because nobody would put it out on Blu-ray. Shout Factory finally did, and they include the sequels as well, Tiger Cage 2 and 3, which are not as good, but it doesn't matter. There are bonuses on here. Tiger Kid, this is directed by Yuen Woo Ping, of course, you know, legendary of early Jackie Chan and all the way to The Matrix. Tiger Cage is great, great action stuff. And it's kind of the movie that made Donnie Yen a superstar.
Yep.
Donnie Yen also made Iron Monkey along with Yurong Guang, which is the story of a kind of a Lone Ranger-y, Zorro-y type hero played by Yurong Guang, who wears a mask, and Donnie Yen is this dad who, you know, winds up allying himself with him. Tiger Cage had a good run here in a hacked up version from Miramax and Harvey Weinstein. I actually interviewed Donnie for the first time at my house for that and got a piece in the LA Times. So I was the first person to interview Donnie Yen for a major American newspaper. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this movie. Yes, yes. But it's a great movie. It is a great movie. Iron Monkey, awful lot of fun. Donnie Yen is terrific.
Just the one, not the not the set. Iron Monkey 2,
No, no, no. Just Iron Monkey 1. That's it. Okay. No other Iron Monkeys. Yeah, and it's really the only one you need to see. Mm. Donnie Yen also stars in Sakura, which is a little bit of an offbeat thing for him, but it's also, you know, wuxia. It's based on a novel that I'm not familiar with. You know, it was never released here in English. Yeah, it's you know, he's like a gritty martial arts master, and he's been accused of murder, and you know, he has to come out of exile and clear his name. And you know, it's a kind of a familiar trope, but it's still great. Mm. Jet Li, The Legend of Fong Sai-yuk 1 and 2, a double feature, that is absolutely to die for. This is wonderful. These movies have not been properly released until now on Blu-ray, and get them both. They're absolutely a joy. I remember seeing these at a Hong Kong Film Festival right when they were initially released in the early 90s. They define Jet Li. He had only done the Shaolin Temple movies of significance before this, and these just put him over the top. These movies are hilarious, brilliant, funny, eccentric, beautifully shot. You just can't do better. Heart of Dragon, Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung together. This is like if you had done Rain Man as a martial arts film, that's what this is. Sammo plays a mentally handicapped guy. Jackie is his brother, and they have an awful lot of fun over the course of this movie. Don't think too much about the plot. It's really, really fun. And then more Jackie Chan's in 2 volumes, the Jackie Chan collection, both of these from Shout Select. This is essential for anybody who wants to be a Jackie Chan completist. There's just an unbelievable amount of good stuff on here, but you got to kind of know the films a little bit. There's audio commentaries galore, backdrops on Jackie's career, and you know, a lot of great stuff. Armor of God and Armor of God 2, Operation Condor, are both here, absolutely essential. Crime Story and City Hunter, super fun. The Crime Story is very serious. City Hunter is based on the video game. It's a little bit wacky. You know, I'm always amused at this, by the way, City Hunter. Here's a little detour on City Hunter. So what's his face? Norton. I forget get his first name.
The bad guy. Oh, Richard Norton.
Richard Norton. Thank you. Yeah. So Richard Norton plays the bad guy here. And City Hunter is basically Die Hard on a cruise ship. And, you know, you get some things that are not PC, like Jackie looks at a woman's chest and there's like this little, these hamburgers, like these hamburgers appear where her breasts are. And he reaches out because he's hungry. It's dumb, wacky, campy humor like that. We'll never fly today. There's a musical interlude. Like a, you know, like a teen boy band performs. It's all very, very odd movie. For reasons that you would understand if you're a Hong Kong fan, the director of City Hunter is a bit of a legendary figure. Yeah. But anyway, but here's the thing. Richard Norton, this is a white guy in Hong Kong who clearly understands his job is to play the bad guy in every single movie. There are no legit acting opportunities for him. And, you know, he's good with that.
Yeah, he just plays out. Hey, and kept him going through a whole bunch of movies.
That's it. So The Killer Meteors is on one of these volumes as well. Shaolin Wooden Men. There's just a lot of stuff here. Dragon Fist. So, you know, Winners and Sinners is an awful lot of fun. The Protector in its original cut, not the American cut, the original Hong Kong cut. So, I mean, this is, you know, Twinkle, Twinkle, Lucky Stars. These are great sets. You got to get these. These films are great transfers. Many of them have never been transferred here, have been shown here in proper form. So it's essential. Mm. And then lastly, a ton of Shaw Brothers stuff. So this is courtesy. Shaw Brothers will not keep their library together. So you got to piecemeal this stuff together a little bit. So we have Shaw Brothers Classics, volume 1 and 2 from Shout. And there's a ton of amazing stuff here. The Assassin is top notch. Brothers 5 is legendary. There's like 11 or 12 movies on each of these things. The Flying Guillotine is here, which I absolutely adore. The Master of the Flying Guillotine, not here. I've done two audio commentaries for that. But The Flying Guillotine is the sequel, and it's fine. Not as good as the original, but it's fine. That's here, and that's nice. Man of Iron, The Bells of Death, The Flying Dagger, which wants to be a flying guillotine.
All this
stuff is really, really great. That's on the Shout Factory sets. And then we have volume 2 of the Shaw Scope set series from Arrow, which is, that's the top tier stuff. That's the really, really hot stuff. This thing is amazing. This is a big, beautiful box set like the previous volume is. And this includes double features on every single one of these discs. There are 8 discs, and the movies are My Young Auntie, Magnificent Ruffians, 10 Tigers of Kwantung, 36th Chamber of Shaolin, Legendary Disciples of the 36th Chamber, Return to the 36th Chamber, Mad Monkey Kung Fu, The Kid with the Golden Arm. All of these things are legendary films. You can't go wrong with any of this stuff. So if you're a Shaw Brothers fan, you will love all of this.
All right.
And let me just pull out a couple of, hold on here. Couple of Japanese titles here. Hideo Gosha made a lot of great samurai movies and gangster movies. We've got Samurai Wolf 1 and 2. If you're a Gosha fan, those are really, really good. Also great from the gangster end of things is Violent Streets. So these are all from Film Movement. And then we've got Ultraman versus Red King. And Ultraman, this is like a... This is from Mill Creek. This is a part of their Ultraman Battle Kaiju series, and this is the first volume, so there's going to be a lot of these. Ultraman versus Red King is basically Ultraman versus a really, really bad Godzilla suit. That's all I can. That's what it appears to be to me. I'm not a big fan of the Ultraman movies from that period, so I couldn't tell you. A more serious recent movie is Ultraman Shin or Shin Ultraman. Excuse me. And the visual effects are basically still just as cheesy, but it's got a little bit more of a modern sheen on it. And it's, you know, you'll recognize some of the actors in here. Like, for example, Kimio Tamura, who was in Drive My Car. that's the character.
Yeah.
The actress is Hidehoshi Nishimura, I guess.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, it's the actress from Drive My Car.
Yeah.
Who stars in it. So you'll recognize her. And Warm Water Under a Red Bridge. Tim, did you ever see this?
I don't think I did.
Okay. So Shohei Imamura, who has won 2 Palme d'Ors at the Cannes Film Festival, made this. What year was this? I can't even remember what year it was. This is like 20 years ago. Yeah, it's 2001. So I saw this and I reviewed this for Box Office at the time. This is a weird, surreal, wonderful fable. It's magical, but it's a totally, totally creepy movie. And it connects. It's mystical. It is clearly symbolic. I don't know that it's based on anything ancient, but it all takes place in a small village, and without giving anything away, there's a woman who her reproductive system is connected in some respects to the stream in the village.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how or why. It still doesn't make sense to me, but when it is poetic the way that it is all executed in a very creepy and weird way. But It is a very unique film. And then Japanese filmmaker Naomi Kawase, a couple of films from her, Still the Water and Radiance, both of which are very, very beautiful and poignant and poetic. Wonderful filmmaker. Those are, if you're a fan of Kawase, these are worth checking out. Again, the films are Radiance and Still the Water from Film Movement. An anime film turned live action called Whisper of the Heart. Totally bizarre. I don't get it at all. It's got some sweet acting and a cat. And otherwise, I've never seen the anime. I don't think I want to after seeing that. Kore-eda, beautiful, wonderful filmmaker of Shoplifters, which was Oscar nominated.
Miyazaki is one of the writers of that. I was just noticing that Whispers of the Heart movie. He's not a director, but
one of the writers of the original anime.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know what I don't know it either, but yeah.
It's a little bit odd, but it is what it is. And then the Kore-eda film Broker, which is lovely, absolutely lovely. Kind of continues some of the themes that he started in Shoplifters, and Song Kang-ho, the great Korean actor, is the star, and it's really beautiful. This never got a great release because of the pandemic, but it's worth rediscovering right now. Broker, beautiful.
Yeah, one of the ones I talked about on Film Week. Very good.
It's good, right? It is. It's really good. And then the last two are basically Japanese gangster movies. Yakuza Graveyard finally gets its Blu-ray premiere. Hasn't been out before. Kenji Fukasaku, the great gangster film director from Japan. This is an epic film. You know, Yakuza Graveyard, just trust me, it's amazing. And then the Game Trilogy, which includes the movies The Most Dangerous Game, The Killing Game, The Execution Game, all starring Yusaku Matsuda. And it's just good. Solid 1970s, late 1970s era, gangster crime stuff. Great era for Japanese cinema. Movies are tough, not overly graphic, and you'll have a lot of fun. Really, really well written, but they're straight up kind of noir genre films and beautifully, beautifully shot. That's it for the great Asian titles. So let's talk about new stuff, television, 4K. You tell me.
Real quick, if you don't mind popping over to The Arrow, just because there are a couple of movies in there, Last Starfighter, the Mallrats, World of the World, from the 80s and 90s, the early days that I really, really dig, particularly Last Starfighter, Nick Castle's film, which I happened to, there was this wonderful documentary series called In Search for Tomorrow. And you remember that thing I did with all those sci-fi movies from the 80s and Last Starfighter was one of them. And Lance Guest was one of the folks on the panel that I was on there. It was really lovely to talk to him. And we had a really wonderful chat about that movie and how it really was, at the precipice, at the beginning of that era of films. This is like 1984. The technology, the CGI is not quite there yet. But I remember seeing this movie. Catherine Mary Stewart and Lance Guest and all the Daniel Harrell and really, really thoroughly enjoying it and thinking it was a whole lot of fun.
This movie has been talked about for a remake for a while, and I'm not sure you could capture the magic of it, because it was a moment when video games were innocent. Like, video games now are so sophisticated that we expect everything to be kind of like Ender's Game isn't even realistic now. Like, everyone expects, like, oh yeah, I could totally defeat an alien empire because I've been playing whatever game, and people will take it seriously. And the idea of a kid who goes to the arcade and is good enough at a video game that qualifies him to engage in intergalactic battle, that was amazingly sweet and innocent on an E.T. level kind of wish fulfillment thing in the 80s.
Yeah,
it really was.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of fun. Anyway, so that was one of the ones there that I really, really sort of dug from way back then. And then Mallrats. Look, say what you want about Kevin Smith. Every now and again, he got one right. This is one that I thought that he got right. I think that this film really does capture the zeitgeist of a moment, 1990, whatever the heck it was, 2, 3, 4, 5, Shannon Doherty and Jason Lee and Jeremy Lin and all of these sort of folks from that period, including those characters that Kevin and whoever that knuckle is, you were. But then through the film, you got Ben Affleck walking around before he became Batman and everything else. Jason Mewes, that's the guy.
Yeah,
and you still got Stan Lee. He shows up in one of those Sulla Stanley moments, you know, that he does. And just all that cast of characters.
I had forgotten that.
Oh, yeah, he's in there. He's in there.
Forgotten that.
That whole thing. So anyway, this was one that malls are gone. There are no more malls. So one day in the future, the title of this film won't even make any sense to some people.
That's so true. That's so true.
Waterworld, same year, 95.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner's big, gigantic movie, such a huge movie, so much anticipated for this film that they built an entire theme presentation at Universal Studios here for the film, which long after the film flopped at the box office, that Waterworld theme, it's not a ride, it's like a presentation thing, which I attended many times, was still there. And I have to tell you, Waterworld is a film that, you know, it took a good kick. Kevin Reynolds directing.
Yeah, they were saying Road Warrior on water.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. I remember thoroughly enjoying this film at the time, and in the many years since, having, you know, when it pops up here, it pops up there. It gets me to sit down and watch it for a little while. It's a very energetic film. You know, it's a lot of fun, and Dennis Hopper is just having a damn good time in this
movie. He really is. And it's worth noting, Waterworld, Mallrats, and The Last Starfighter, all on 4K. These are their 4K debuts from Arrow. One other one from Arrow, not a 4K. It's only Blu-ray, but make quick mention of The Assassination Bureau, which is a super fun film that has been out a few times, but never with all these, never looking as good as this and with some of the extras that this has. It has a new audio commentary with Sean Hogan and Kim Newman, and a 30-minute appreciation by broadcaster and historian Matthew Sweet, which kind of puts this thing in its context. For those who don't know, this is I don't want to call it a superhero movie. It's kind of like a Mission Impossible-y sort of thing that is set in 1908, just before World War I, based on a novel that Jack London never finished. Mm-hmm. And it was published after he died. But it's really, really, it has a really fun vibe to it. Diana Rigg and Oliver Reed and Telly Savalas, all people who have, you know, a certain genre identification for us. And, you know, it's great. Diana Rigg plays a very early kind of suffrage, activist, and she, you know, discovers this, this secret group called the Assassination Bureau, and they've been around a long time, and all the pieces start falling into place, and it's really quite fun. Oliver Reed is really has a lot of fun with this. It's one of his most enjoyable parts. So, Assassination Bureau.
Diana Rigg. Anything with young Diana Rigg, forget about it. Any Diana Rigg.
What do we do? We can do Criterion.
Criterion, if you don't mind, because there are a few there. I was doing After Hours, for instance, is at the top of that list. And Criterion, After Hours, Martin Scorsese's film, and I was talking about something, and this movie came up. Oh, I know what it was. It was Bo is Afraid, the Ari Aster,
which we're also talking about. So, want to talk about that in the same?
I guess we squeeze them all together because the one thing, not nuts about a lot of Ari Aster, but certainly Bo is Afraid is an interesting film. It's really, really long. But when I got to thinking about it, I could tell that it was drawing a lot from, at a minimum, After Hours, if not some other sort of films from the period that had that sort of sense of a roaming character just roaming around through. And there's a lot there. This to me is a lot more fun than Bo is Afraid, which is, you know, has more in common probably with, the guy that wrote Adaptation. Charlie Kaufman. Yeah, a lot of that kind of, you know, connected, all that kind of stuff there. But anyway, this movie I remember liking a whole lot, and it's kind of off the beaten path for young Martin Scorsese.
Well, After Hours is also a 4K debut. Tons of extras on here, including a commentary with Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker, and another commentary with Scorsese and Scorsese and Schoonmaker and Michael Ballhouse. And Griffin Dunn is in on it as well. I've not had a chance to listen to that yet, but I will,
That would be neat. That would be neat.
Yeah, gotta be neat. Bo is Afraid, while as long as we're on the subject, that's also out. Comes with it from Lionsgate, gets a digital copy on it. I have not watched this. I know you watched some of it.
Yeah, a good chunk of it.
It's three hours long.
Yeah. You know, and look, as I say often about Ari, he makes films that are interesting, that I find interesting, but he's yet to make a film that I actually like. Midsommar and Hereditary. Yeah. And they're very, internal and all of this, and I appreciate the filmmaking, but, I don't actually like any of these movies. And this is another one, Joaquin Phoenix. It's a film about a guy and his relationship with his mother, is an extremely unhealthy relationship with his mother, and how that manifests itself inside his psyche, his internal psyche, his external existence. It's divided into these sort of like large chapters that we sort of work our way through, but that's at the end of the day what's going on. Every place, whether it's inside his mind or in the real world, there is his mother lurking over him and his guilt and all kinds of things. I will say this, Joaquin, again, in a very, very committed performance of a movie that I appreciate but don't actually like.
Using the word committed very loosely.
Yeah.
So other 4Ks from Criterion here, let's kind of, pick and choose. And
Breathless. I see that one.
Breathless. Yeah. Godard is Breathless on 4K, a movie that was not even shot on 4K. It was shot on 16mm with, a lot of grit. I can tell you this. I don't know that movie needs to be in 4K, because there isn't 4K worth of data on that original 16mm film.
Yeah.
But I am grateful for what they did, because it certainly does feel richer and more kind of in the moment, especially all the scenes where you see everybody on the streets of Paris looking into the camera and thinking, what are these people doing? Mm. I mean, this is guerrilla filmmaking, 101.
Yeah. Talk about Friedkin. None of these guys went to film school either. Yeah. It's interesting that 4K. What I noticed is that it renders things that were never really black, black and white. We say black and white, but there was never anything in that film that was actually black or white. Yeah. It was not really. In the 4K, there are things that are black and there are things that are white. There's a silhouette of when Gene Seberg is walking through an alcove toward the light. And she and he, but mostly she, is carved out in black and white. That was never that crisp before.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of interesting, and I don't know that it's correct, but when they're running down the streets, black and white at night.
Yeah.
The lights of the cars, it's black and it's white, which is, that's interesting.
Also on 4K, and a very strange choice for Criterion to go 4K on this. So I will let Tim weigh in on why he thinks they did this. I have no idea. The Renowned Westerns by Bud Boddicker with Randolph Scott. That's Renown, Ranown. And the films, this is five films in a box set. The Tall T, Decision at Sundown, Buchanan Rides Alone, Ride Lonesome, and Comanche Station. I am not a fan of any of these. I'm not really a fan of Randolph Scott generally, but I get he had a moment where these films were, these are all kind of late 50s, early 60s, 57 to 60 is when the films were made.
Yeah, some of that foundational material, which I know more, the Tall T, I think it's Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. Elmore. So I don't know, the sort of foundational material in some of that stuff, because Elmore was basically doing noir. So the Tall T, that would be an example of how noir can be in any genre. Because that's a noir. But there you go.
Why on 4K though? Why would we put those five films in 4K?
There's a lot of saturation in some of them, but I don't know. It's a good question. It's a good question. Yeah, you crank up to the Vinci, but it's not like it's not like these were ever Technicolor or anything like that.
No. Well, anyway, we also have Thelma and Louise in 4K. You know, Ridley Scott kind of stopped doing genre stuff and became a real filmmaker in the eyes of a lot of people with this movie. They thought, wow, it doesn't have aliens, or it's not futuristic. It's not, you know, kind of action-y. It doesn't have that genre-y thing that he's being associated with, because he had done prior to this pretty much it was, you know, The Duelists. Which was, you know, still an action sort of thing. Alien and Blade Runner and Legend. And, you know, suddenly he's doing something that is just a legit drama. Boom. Yeah, filmmaker.
Yeah.
A lot of great extras. Documentary in here that features everybody. And, you know, does this film hold up? Tim, does it hold up for you?
Well, actually, it does. You know, this is really one of my favorite films of 91. I guess it's 91.
It's 30 years old.
Oh, yeah. You're there, Callie Corey there, and Gina and Harvey. And interesting that for Ridley Scott, you know, you think of Ridley Scott, and what Ridley Scott turned out to be was a woman's director.
Yeah.
You know, obviously Ripley, Sigourney Weaver, and this film here and a few others. You wouldn't have thought that about Ridley. But when it comes to Ridley, that's what he turned out to be, a woman's director. Even that film that he made with the one with Adam Driver and that's really her film. So does this hold up in a certain sort of way? Culturally, does it hold up? That's really the question, right? Because culturally, over the years, this film has taken a beat down, and then it kind of had a cultural comeback in the sort of the post Me Too sort of movement. So it's an interesting sort of thing. I always was feeling it way back in 91. But it's interesting to see how the culture sort of puts a film through the ringers in some ways.
Akira Kurosawa's Dreams in 4K is a wonderful thing. This is 4K and Blu-ray combo, and it is a wonderful thing. I first saw this film projected. It was shot in HD. It looked ugly. It didn't look the way it needed to look because it was HD and they transferred it to film, and all the technology was a little bit wrong. It's been very beautifully cleaned up. Wonderful. All the colors are vibrant like they were not at the time in 1990. And, you know, what a lot of people remember most about this is Martin Scorsese playing Vincent van Gogh and disappearing into his own paintings. And you're like, wow, Martin Scorsese directed by Kurosawa. Who knew? There's a great audio commentary on here by Stephen Prince. Really, really beautiful. It contextualizes everything perfectly. And then a documentary by Catherine Cadu, who's been a longtime translator for Akira Kurosawa. Great interviews here. Bertolucci is interviewed, Inarritu, Hayao Miyazaki, and Scorsese. Really, really good stuff. So a lot of great extras on here. I'm still waiting for a big old Kurosawa box set, but in the meantime, 4K for Dreams, which is, you know, a series of vignettes based on his actual dreams. Like Kurosawa made these little short films about his dreams.
It's interesting. Yoshiro Honda, not usually credited with some of the writing that he did on some of those sequences there, which is always sort of interesting. I hope they correct that in that box set and they talk about a little bit about Yoshiro Honda's connection to some of that.
I don't know, but I will absolutely check. And the last of the 4K criterions is One False Move, Carl Franklin's One False Move, which introduced the world to Cinda Williams and Billy Bob Thornton, and Bill Paxton was kind of came of age. You know, Cinda Williams was in the Last Call, that little bar film that my friends shot at Lacey Street, where I was wrangling extras. So got to meet Cinda Williams there. She was the femme fatale in that film. You know, One False Move is a seminal movie, and yet it's kind of forgotten. Carl Franklin's directing career went back to TV not too many years later. Billy Bob Thornton doesn't really show up much anymore. So why should, I mean, I've been trying to figure this out. This is such a seminal film, but it didn't create a huge amount of momentum for everyone in it. Not like it would if it were today.
Well, it was a momentum for the moment, You know, and I knew a lot of these cats back in this is 91, 91. And you know, there they were. Oddly, Billy Bob, who had been acting, you know, I think he was on a sitcom or something like that. And he had he had written something else. I can't remember what it was. And then Billy Bob had that career as an actor and a director. What did he do? Sling Blade. He did Sling Blade and whatever. And then he would be in these big old movies, Armageddon. And I think he pops up in Oliver Stone's U-Turn. It's this really weird thing that went on with Angelina Jolie for a while that we've all forgotten about. You remember Billy Bob and Angelina? That was a whole thing like that. And, you know, but, you know, you have these sort of solid workaday folks. Michael Beach came out of this movie. Bill, like you said, Bill Paxton came out of this movie. Cinder was in Spike's Mo' Better Blues a year or two out of this movie. But, and, you know, and then it just sort of, it's an interesting kind of thing. But today, this gritty little movie, which was really considered along the lines of like, what's that that film, Straw Dogs? Peckinpah. This was considered a sort of Peckinpah moment,
right on
in 91. That's how intense some of the stuff that happens at the top of this movie.
Well, Carl Franklin is only 74, considering that Ridley Scott is 86 and directed Napoleon. Somebody should be throwing some great work at Carl Franklin and letting him make some great movies again, because he's one of the best directors of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
The last three criterions here, not on on 4K, but on Blu-ray. There is Bo Widerberg's new Swedish cinema, which includes the four films, Elvira Madigan, The Baby Carriage, Raven's End, and Odalen 31. Elvira Madigan, really the only one there that I'm particularly fond of and that most people are familiar with. But, you know, Widerberg or Widerberg, however you want to pronounce it, certainly was one of the hallmark Swedish directors in the 1960s alongside Ingmar Bergman and a few of the others who came out of that school. So, you know, that's a nice box set.
Yeah.
Wayne Wang's Dim Sum, A Little Bit of Heart.
Oh, yeah.
Nice little low-budget movie that helped, along with Wang is Missing, Chan is Missing.
Yeah, Chan is Missing.
Along with Chan is Missing, launched Wayne Wang's career.
Yeah.
And Dim Sum's a really sweet film. So, I mean, I like later Wayne Wang more than the early stuff, but you certainly see where he's coming from with a lot of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And The Watermelon Woman by Cheryl Dunier, which is also on Criterion Channel right now. You can watch this on the channel, too. You know, this is a terrific movie from 1996. What happened to her since then?
Well, she has a career in television. You know, you look over there, you'll see her L Word and all that kind of stuff. This film here, you know, at this particular moment in time, it's funny because I think you and I and Ray, our buddy Ray Green, had a conversation about whether or not she would have been considered a part of the L.A. Rebellion.
Exactly.
At that time, that sort of late 90s. Would that be like right before you, right after you at UCLA?
Yeah. LA Rebellion kind of starts just before me. It's around 83, 84 that it starts, and it kind of sort of ends in some people's minds around 1990, which is when I was there.
Mm.
So it's you know, it's an imprecise thing, but the actual filmmakers who were part of it, they basically span late 70s to about mid 80s.
Mm.
That's when their work is there. So I would include it personally, because I think that if nothing else, she is a descendant, an offspring of that movement, and certainly pays homage to it.
Yeah.
But I get why it's a you know, a question mark.
So, well, certainly in terms of the gay and lesbian center, cinema, it would be foundational there for sure, for whether or not. Yeah, interesting. But no, yeah, really, really great movie. And I'm glad it's getting the Criterion Collection treatment. That's really great.
I am too. And especially because it ties into a performer from the 1930s who was known as the Watermelon Woman, which is this wonderful kind of the mystery at the middle of this. And it's really great. It's a terrific film. It really is. It's a really, really strong independent entry. Another from a decade that was just filled with them. Where next? What should we hit?
Let's see. How about we dash ourselves over to some of that Warner archive material? There's a whole bunch there. Excuse me. And check out some of that. The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Is that the series, the complete series?
No, that's the original Vincent Minnelli movie.
Okay, the Vincent Minnelli movie. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, no, no, that's the. So here we go. Let's plow through it. The original Vincent Minnelli movie with Glenn Ford and Shirley Jones.
Yes.
Really interesting because, you know, the idea of broken families and single parents was a thing that was really only explored in the 1960s. And there were a ton of those TV shows. We talk about it, right? I mean, the 60s had, you know, the Brady Bunch combined two of them, and there's Family Affair and the Andy Griffith Show.
And My Three Sons and all that stuff. It was like a thing, man, for a while.
It was.
Ron Howard, I had forgotten, played Eddie.
Yep.
And because you always, when I think of this, I always think of the television show, you know, Bill Bixby. Yep. But Ron Howard played Eddie. Man, that guy, his career, both as an actor and then, you know, a writer, director, filmmaker, unparalleled, I think, in this town.
It's really true.
Just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's
really true. Yeah. King Solomon's Mines with Stuart Granger and Deborah Carr. Kind of, I don't know if this dates all that well, but it's kind of fun in a cheesy way a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, a little pre on the heels of the Indiana Jones movie doing whatever it did.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. It's sort of pre that, a sort of inspiration for that, this.
We got Ruben Mamoulian and directing, you know, Greta Garbo in one of her final films as Queen Christina. I would say just watch it because of Garbo. If you haven't seen Garbo, it's just there is a thing about her. I don't know what it is. It's just she's icy and she's compelling and she's sexy in a way that was not visible in movies at that time. It's just there's something about her. There really is.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm looking at her next to a picture of Gal Gadot right now. You know, obviously both young. Garbo would have to be young. I think she would act when she's like 36 or something. People forget how much longer she lived. You would see Greta Garbo roaming around, you know, old Greta Garbo roaming around the streets of New York in the 80s.
Yep.
Because she owned all this property on the Upper East Side. And she would just be roaming around being Greta Garbo. And if you didn't know who she was, and you wouldn't if you hadn't seen her since 35 years, you wouldn't have known that that's Greta Garbo. She did that for years and years and years.
And there's a great Sidney Lumet movie called Garbo Talks with Ron Goldman and Anne Bancroft, and I dearly love that movie. I love it, and people just diss on it. Dori Sherry, great producer, great old indie producer, did The Boy with Green Hair.
Oh, yes.
Back in the day, and I this is such a popular film for so many people, and I just don't get it. I have never gotten it. I just don't. It's like this weird kind of nuclear age pre-civil rights era attempt to create a metaphor, which for me just doesn't work at all. And Joseph Losey directed it, and I'm inclined to think the only reason anyone remembers this is because Losey directed it.
Yeah, Losey. You got young Dean Stockwell roaming around this movie. He's the kid, and if you watch it today, Barbara Hale is in this movie. She's a Perry Mason's secretary. It is sort of a neat sort of walk down memory lane in that sort of way. But you're right, Dwayne Hickman is in this movie. But you're right, it's an odd little movie that's a reference to all kinds of things. So yeah. What
are you gonna do? Hey there, it's Yogi Bear. Really, nothing else to say about this. This was a feature length Yogi Bear movie, and it overstays its welcome a little bit, but back in the day, I thoroughly enjoyed it. So there is now the feature length Blu-ray of Hey There, Yogi. It's Yogi Bear. The original Women in Prison movie before Jonathan Demme started doing them is Caged.
Yeah.
Caged was quite a thing in its day in 1960. I think this was 1950.
It's the John Cromwell film, right? That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Eleanor Parker and Agnes Moorehead and Ellen Corby, who was later on The Waltons. Everybody, you know, nobody had done a Women in Prison movie. I guess I got to give them credit for it. It's not I don't think it's that great, but, you know, it's Dangerous When Wet, a great Esther Williams movie from MGM. It's an Esther Williams movie. You know, it's a little schmaltzy. It's a little melodramatic. You're really watching it just so that you can see Esther Williams do some Busby Berkeley style water dance with Tom and Jerry. That's really all it is. And that's, you know, there it is. It's just another one of those movies. Helen of Troy is maybe the only decent movie ever made about the actual Helen of Troy story. It's a little cheesy. It's a little bit sword and sandal ish, but it's directed by Robert Wise, you know, so that's worth something. Right?
Absolutely. Robert Wise, you get me? Star Trek, a little Star Trek, a little,
All right. Well, that's, nice CineScope, story of Helen of Troy. No one's done another one since. Glenn Ford, Broderick Crawford, and Gene Crane in an MGM Western called The Fastest Gun Alive, which is perfectly fine. It's a good, solid Western, and Glenn Ford, who is, graduated from my high school. Mm-hmm. Good, solid Western guy. I don't know if there's much else you can say about it. Joan Crawford and David Bryan in The Damned Don't Cry. Crawford totally holds this down. Better movie than I recall it being originally, but it's still kind of a hard-boiled B-level noir.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely. Yeah.
Hang on with that.
That's the Angel Face there, Olive Preminger's film.
Oh yeah.
I remember liking that movie a lot. For one thing, it's Robert Mitchum and Gene Simmons, ridiculously beautiful Gene Simmons, Angel Face. Speaking of which, that was a really, really good movie. I love that one a lot.
And produced, Preminger directed it for Howard Hughes. Mm-hmm. Howard Hughes was from that Hughes moment. That is a good film, and anything with Mitchum and.
Howard Hughes was into Gene Simmons too, I think.
A couple of Academy Award Best Picture winners here. The original Simran, based on the Edna Ferber novel, by many considered to be the worst Best Picture winner in history. Mm. I think that's being a little cruel. It's about the 1899 Oklahoma land rush, which is kind of also the subject of Far and Away, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I mean, it won Best Picture because it has a huge, epic land rush moment in it. And everybody looked at that and said, holy cow, how did they pull that off? And in the early 30s, that was a big deal. So, I mean, Simran is an important historical artifact. A little more important is the Broadway Melody, which was also a Best Picture winner. And I think a very, very deserving one. This was Harry Beaumont's MGM effort, which was one of the first big musicals that really kind of showed what musicals could do and what they could do with sound and kind of trying to open up the capabilities of movies.
And they would repeat it again and again and again. Broadway Melody 36, Broadway Melody 37, Broadway Melody 38.
Oh, man, they made a ton of these. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the original Broadway Melody, and it is a nice artifact. It really kind of holds up in some interesting ways.
Yeah.
Let's talk for a second about The Old Man and the Sea, the Spencer Tracy adaptation of the Hemingway. John Sturges, great widescreen director here. We know him from things like, the Dirty Dozen and... a lot of other great movies. Does this capture the book? Because it's been a long time since I read the book.
It's very presentational and traditional, but I suppose the book is too. So to the extent that something, can capture the book in that way, I would say that it does. Looking at this, it's really funny. You can see the matte paintings, back there. True. You can kind of see all that stuff there. So the sense of dire in this is sort of gone. But on the other hand, in that presentational sort of form, Spencer Face Tracy doing that sort of accent thing that he's doing there. But it's a moving movie. I kind of like it.
A musical that tends to get overlooked a lot is from the early 40s. Du Barry Was a Lady. And this is before she was on, before she had her own TV show, Lucille Ball, had a moment where she was on the verge of being a musical movie star. And she is the object of affection for, are you ready for it? Red Skelton and Gene Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting over Lucille Ball. Very, very peculiar little bit of casting there. Tommy Dorsey and Zero Mostel are in here for the ride. Arthur Freed produced it. Roy Del Ruth directed it. Good, solid MGM bunch of people. I think it's a fun movie, but it is certainly in light of what all of them did later, Red Skelton Show and all of Gene Kelly's other movies, and you know, Singing in the Rain and her, you know,
this movie is why Lucy came to be known as a redhead. She wasn't a redhead. This movie is why she's so beautiful, and this Technicolor is a redhead. She decided to adopt it as her hair color for the rest of her career.
Isn't that wild?
It starts with this movie.
And then Elizabeth Taylor and Van Johnson, absolutely delightful in The Last Time I Saw Paris, which also features Walter Pidgeon and Donna Reed. Good, solid melodrama, good, solid MGM melodrama from the early 1950s. Very much in the moment. The fashion is so 1950s. Just seeing Donna Reed and Elizabeth Taylor in those great 50s fashions is just terrific.
Yeah,
it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit in that Peyton Place mold. It captures the moment of the post-war malaise and post-war hope all at the same time. And it's set in Paris, for crying out loud. You just can't go wrong with this. Richard Brooks keeps everything from getting a little bit too melodramatic. It's based on an F. Scott Fitzgerald story, but very loosely adapted by Brooks and the Epstein brothers. But I think it's perfectly wonderful. I think it's a great film, and it ages very, very well.
It suggests the kind of work that he would go on to do. He did a lot of writing, Richard Brooks, but he would go on to do. It's kind of like what we're talking about with Freakin', this sort of really realistic sort of thing.
Yeah.
As a director, and they would become more and more realistic. So you get your Alma Gantry and you're In Cold Blood, and you're, before you know it, you're looking for Mr. Goodbar, which is just like, you know, absolute realism there. And this sort of walks into that path.
Let's hit a few of these new movies, because there's some good stuff to make mention of here. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I didn't think made enough at the box office, because I am not a girl. I have never been a girl. I don't know what it means to be a girl. But I hear that this book is like the coming of age book and has been for over a generation. And they have a whole piece of this movie where a lot of famous people just go, oh, I read it when I was 8. I read it when I was 12. And it saved me. And it defined life for me. And it's like, you go, holy cow, what am I watching here? And it is darn good. Mm. It is darn good. I really, really love this movie. And it's weird that I loved it.
The film is set, you know, it's set in the era when the book was the book was referencing.
Yes.
I'll put it like that. That's correct. It's set in the era.
Bloom moment. Judy Bloom 60s, 70s moment. Yeah.
And I wonder if that has something to do, because obviously, you know, that's very, with why it didn't quite connect with a contemporary young lady audience.
That's a good point.
The equivalent of the, because these girls, you're looking at, you know, I'm looking at, I enjoyed it too, but then again, I'm from this era. I'm not a girl either, by the way, but I am from this period, and all of this rang true to me with respect to my big sister and folks like that.
I think everybody in this is great. Rachel McAdams, Abby Ryder Fortson, and Kathy Bates, three generations right there, mother, grandmother, and daughter. I think they're all going to be in the running for some kind of awards consideration, and I think this film will come back at awards season and people will rediscover how wonderful it is.
I do hope it is remembered. That would be great. Yeah.
Sisu is an absolutely bonkers Finnish film in English. It takes place at the end of World War II. The Nazis are on the run. They're going into Finland and they're wrecking everything in their path, and they make a very big mistake. They find an old guy, a crusty old Finnish guy who's on a horse, and he's dragging a bag of gold with him, and they decide to try to steal his gold.
Oh, no.
What they don't realize is this guy is like Mad Max, Dirty Harry, and Batman rolled into one times 10, and he decides it is going to be the end of them and the death of them, and he's going to get his gold back and make them pay. And this old guy is just not to be believed. This movie is brutal and gory to the nth degree.
Who's going to play this guy in the English?
Oh, in an American remake?
Oh yeah. Who's going to play this guy? I'm sorry. This is an American remake. Now they'll probably just nowadays they'll just dub it and put it on Netflix. Yeah. But who would have? Because it's just really that good.
I don't know. I mean, I would have, you know, it would have been Clint Eastwood 20 years ago, not Clint today. It would have been Nick Nolte 10 years ago.
Charlie Bronson 40 years ago.
I don't know. But man, what a crazy movie. I'm also a big fan of Fool's Paradise. Mm-hmm. Charlie Day wrote, directed, stars in. Nice throwback. It's like being there. You love this movie too. We had fun with this.
Yeah.
It's like being there crossed with Chaplin and Keaton and all the rest of the great silent comics. And it's about this hapless homeless guy who doesn't utter a word in the whole movie, played by Charlie Day, who's literally stumbles into movie stardom.
Yeah.
And somehow it just works out for him. This movie is absolutely hilarious. And Ken Jeong plays his agent and manager, who also stumbles into discovering him. Great supporting bits from a ton of people. Malkovich and Jason Bateman. Ray Liotta's in here as a crime boss. It's fantastic. Kate Beckinsale is the movie star he winds up marrying. It's just too funny.
Really, I mean, if you like Peter Sellers being there, that sort of thing, it really lives right in that space. And you can tell that Charlie is a student of all of that. Your Harold Lloyd, your Chaplin, he's a student of all of that. And he brings it to bear. And it's very, 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 very funny.
Yep, it is really funny. There are a couple of laughs in here that just sent me over the edge. Book club, the next chapter. Didn't watch it. Didn't see the first one. Have no interest in doing it. But a bunch of actresses who are well past their prime seem to be having fun. Diane Keaton, Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen, Mary Steenburgen. And I have been told that in this edition of book club, the next chapter, nobody actually reads a book.
Hey, look, I'm not going to talk crap about any. I guess we'll call them senior. Actresses, performers, getting a chance to star in movies. I know that women within the range of these women love these movies. They do.
I know
they love seeing themselves up there on the screen. They love seeing Don Johnson, who I think, by the way, is too young for all these broads. Yeah. you old cradle robbers, you. but nevertheless, what I say about these movies is, hey, give the ladies what they want.
Asteroid City. What'd you think of Asteroid City?
Look, man, you and I have experienced the entirety of Wes Anderson's career. Yeah. We started in this business when there was no Wes Anderson, and he came into those movies. And I got to tell you, these films have gotten more and more twee. And particularly if you think about that first film, Bottle Rocket, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing twee about that film at all. It's a nasty little Jimmy Conn half gangster movie, you know? And then, so now I appreciate what Wes does, but sometimes I feel like he is just, dude, you have got yourself in that little egg that is the universe in which you create this film. This film is a film, is a play set within a film that's on a television show. So we're watching this play about this place called Asteroid City, it's just this whole thing. And you think of it as, it really is at the heart of it, just a lovely little movie about grief. That's all it is. Jason Schwartzman's lost his wife. He's got these kids. But, he's got a raise. That's all it is. But he couldn't just fucking make it. Just make that movie, dude. Just make that movie.
He gets lost in the obsession with style, with having everyone have that kind of monotone delivery, with the camera constantly being on a dolly and moving sideways and then moving sideways again. And all of the style, it's like he's doing a parody of his own. Like he's caught up. He's trapped by the expectations that he himself has created.
Yeah.
And does it have to look like my parents bleached out chromacome slides from 1964? Does it have to look like that bleached and kind of faded? Because that's what the look is, and that's not the 1950s to me.
I like some of the. I like a lot of the performances here. Tom Hanks happens to join his little, cast. Because he has like a little road crew that he drags around in these movies: Jeffrey Wright, Ned Norton, and whatnot. Here, he adds Tom Hanks. He adds Scarlett Johansson. They're good too, but it's just it's all to an end. It's just too twee. If you just made the movie about this subject with all these people, without all this tweeness, I think I would have liked that movie.
Well, let's hit some 4K here. There's a ton of great 4K this week. Most of it is catalog stuff, but it is totally worth it because it all looks great. I am not a huge fan of the movie Ender's Game. Big fan of the book. I think the movie kind of misses the point a little bit, but it's out in an exclusive 4K Steelbook for Best Buy. So you can only get this at Best Buy, Steelbook packaging. But, you know, some people really, really vibe to this. I don't know. Did you like Ender's Game?
The movie? No, I'm more of a more of a the book kind of. Guys, in the actual the actual kind of film. Look, I will admit that it kind of got me. You know, you're not going to give anything away. It's a 10-year-old movie, but whatever. But I was like, oh, you know, okay. But, you know, there you go. Ender's Game.
Rio Bravo, the Howard Hawks muscular Western with John Wayne and Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson, where all three of them seem to be in a totally different movie. Wayne's making a John Wayne movie. Dean Martin is wondering, why am I in a John Wayne movie? And Ricky Nelson is thinking, I'm so going to make money. I need a great paycheck. It's about time I got one of these.
His name's Colorado in that movie. You know what's fabulous about this movie? Angie Dickinson.
Yes.
That's what's fabulous about
that
movie.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Angie, oh my God.
Part of the Warner Brothers 100th anniversary release of a lot of great movies, as is the 40th anniversary, or the what is it now? It's the 50th anniversary of Enter the Dragon on 4K. Still totally holds up. You know, John Saxon, Jim Kelly. Really, I think this movie, it's still great. Sammo Hung is in this as well, very briefly at the beginning. You know, I mean, it defines its era. And this is the movie when Bruce Lee kind of stepped forward and became an international icon, transcending race. And it's the martial arts film that started it for everybody. It started it for me.
Bolo. It's funny. This and hip hop born the same year.
Yeah,
I think it's fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, lots of great extras on this thing. Really, really worth checking out. The Paul Heller, Michael Allen commentary is superb, but it's the 4K that just sings. The movie has never looked more spectacular. Along the new movie front, my gosh, Fast X, it's finally over, or is it?
Or is it? Look, man. This movie was outlandish. I will give it that. But it was outlandish to the point. Look, there's a moment in this movie, I'm not giving anything away, when a giant flaming nuclear weapon is rolling through the streets. Now, it's not just a nuclear, a flaming nuclear. Yeah. It's a CGI. And they're using it. And I'm like, okay, look, guys, the physics of these films have been debated for quite some time. Now they just simply decided that there are no physics in these films. and then they drag everybody, most everybody, not quite everybody, but they drag everybody back to the movie. And I don't know. Is it over? Who knows? I'm not sure it's over.
Shout Factory has given us World War Z on 4K. And I'm wondering, will there be a sequel, as they keep hinting? any thoughts on that?
Good question. Will there be a sequel to World War? There certainly is enough material there for there to be a sequel. And considering how many Walking Dead sequels there have been, I can't imagine they can't sort out, you know, figure out a way to do a sequel to this bad
it's
boy.
It's a great master. I am very fond of this film. Mireya Enos, who plays Brad Pitt's wife in the film. I know the family very well. I've known him for a long time, so I always root for anything that she is in, and I'd love to see her in a sequel. Get it done, Mark Forster. Get the band back together. Do a sequel. It is also the 70th anniversary of Roman Holiday. Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn, and we have a 4K from Paramount with a voodoo code on it, and I highly recommend it. This is simply the most charming movie in the world. Audrey Hepburn held her own against Gregory Peck and won an Academy Award and delivered what I consider to be the archetypal Academy Awards acceptance speech. She went up there and she said, I am so thankful. You've all been so very, very kind. And she walked off. And that was it. That was basically it. She didn't thank her agent. She didn't thank her co-star. She didn't thank anybody. She just said, you've all been so very, very kind. And she was borderline tears. And then she walked away and everyone loved it. Yeah. That's what everyone's speech should be.
Get in, you get out. And the show is over. I love it. I love it. William Wyler, can't go wrong.
It is really. No, you can't go wrong. It's just a wonderful tour of the city. And it's a sweet story. And Gregory Peck is wonderful as a scoundrel who is lovable.
Yeah. A little Dalton Trump.
East of Eden, Elia Kazan, John Steinbeck. I mean, what are we with James Dean, you know, Julie Harris? What do we say about this movie? Does it rock like it did at the time?
Well, you know what, the James Dean being a part of that, the coming of the transition of from that sort of presentational form of acting, which everybody else in this movie is doing, by the way, I mean, everybody, even the good people, Raymond Massey, Julie Harris is very good. They're all good, but they're all engaged in that very classic to the moment presentational form of acting. And then you got this guy, James Dean, who's engaged in this method, you know, inhabiting this character, emotions that seem, and you can, and there are moments that Raymond Massey is plainly uncomfortable.
That's really true. I've never given that any thought, but you're right. You can tell in those moments where Massey almost feels like, what have I gotten myself into?
Like, what the hell is going on with this kid? you know, is somebody going to yell cut? It's losing it, you know? But that is what really elevates those moments in this film. So that's the thing. I teach this film a lot when in acting classes that I do with James Dean, because you know, you can put a marker on him, you can put a marker on Brando, you can put a marker, and then you can follow those guys straight through to your Dustin Hoffman's, your Popeye, who played Popeye, you know, all those guys.
Gene Hackman,
thank you very much. Walk right through.
You know what else is a landmark in method acting? Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Not really.
But you know what I love about Matthew Broderick? Whenever asked, you know, what will be the thing that you remember? He says, Ferris Bueller.
Yes.
You'll be honest. Matthew Broderick played Ferris Bueller, and you know what? He's okay with that, and I love that about him, which is why I think I like that about this movie that much more.
Well, anyway, that's on 4K, a Steelbook edition. This movie holds up. It is more fun to watch than any movie has a right to be. It's John Hughes at his very best. John Hughes always had two sides to him. He had the, you know, the kid, the really inside teenager side, the Breakfast Club side. And then there's the Home Alone side, which is in Vacation, you know, the wacky stuff. And I think it all comes together here. I think this is the consummate John Hughes movie, all sides of his personality. And I love it. And it is on 4K. And, you know, it's got the John Hughes commentary before he died. And you can't go wrong. It's a Steelbook. Do it.
Yeah.
Nightbreed is also on 4K. I don't know why. Maybe you can tell me why this movie has any following at all. Well, I always thought this was just lame.
Clive, Craig Sheffer. Yeah, you know, although David Cronenberg is walking around this movie, and he's a lot of fun walking around this movie, David Cronenberg. It's one of those Clive adaptations before Clive just went completely bonkers. And off the rails. Look, you got to be into Clive, and I've never been particularly into Clive, but you know, if you are, I suppose that this will work for you in the way that those Clive Barker adaptations work. Interesting that he directed it, he wrote it. It's adapted from his own stuff. So what you got is what he intended. So if you ever wanted to get inside his head about what his stuff should look and sound like, this is one.
And then three final 4Ks from Warner Brothers. There is Justice League War World, a DC Universe movie, which is perfectly fine. They're all pretty well written by comics people. And, you know, this one's OK. I mean, it's a little bit. It's the Wonder Woman, Batman, Superman tandem again, and it goes a little bit far afield for my taste, but I know that fans like it. There's also Babylon 5, The Road Home, which is an original Babylon 5 movie. I am not a Babylon 5 junkie like some people are. This is basically an animated thing. So, you know, it's got some original cast member voices. Bruce Boxleitner and Peter Jurassic and Billy Mummy and, you know, a few others. I don't know. It feels like stretching the franchise a little far, but again, I'm not a huge fan of it. And then the first season of The Last of Us, the HBO series, is on 4K, and that'll dovetail us into TV here. How do you feel about The Last of Us? I am very mixed.
I thought it was pretty strong. First of all, I don't know anything about that game. Didn't play the game. Don't know anything about the game. I thought it was pretty strong in terms of its presentation of an apocalyptic narrative. What I liked about it were those standalone. And none of them are standalone, but because it's sort of all out of sequence. So that sequence with Nick Offerman and Mary Bartlett, you know, that I thought was just absolutely extraordinary. And I loved it when it was doing that. The sort of walkthrough narrative, you know, I'm sorry, with all of these Walking Dead, you know, pick whichever one you want to pick. They eventually become repetitive. Yeah. Because there's really only one thing that can happen here. We have our heroes. Our heroes will be under threat of being overtaken by, you know, whatever it is you can overtake them. I think it's mushrooms or some shit in this. I don't know what it is. Or vampire, whatever it is. And then they have to survive that threat. And whoever is lost. And then we do it again. Well, you know, I can only take one season of the Walking Dead doing that. I'm not sure why I would want another whole bunch of seasons of this doing that.
Yeah.
So we shall see what happens.
Let's wrap things out with just a little bit of TV here. The Venture Brothers have a standalone Blu-ray release of Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart. Of all the titles you could go with, that's the one you went with. Okay, fair enough. And this goes along with the Venture Brothers, the complete series on DVD. I just don't know
Never was a Venture Brothers guy. Never was.
Yeah, it's fans only for that one. Tim, you've mentioned Fear the Walking Dead a couple of times.
Yeah.
Seasons 1-7. On a box set here, DVD, not Blu-ray. People should buy it. Not. What do you think?
Well, the one thing I will say about Fear the Walking Dead, I was a Walking Dead guy, but Fear the Walking Dead does in fact have at the center of it some really, 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 really good performances and some excellent actors. So that's what I like about Fear the. Excuse me, Cliff Curtis is in there. You got Coleman Domingo walking around there. You got Lenny James walking around there. So that's what I kind of like. Jenna Elfman is even walking around there. She's good at it, by the way. But that's what I like about this run. Some great performances.
How does it compare to The Walking Dead?
No.
How does it compare to The Walking Dead?
No. It doesn't even come close. Because you can't we do not have the opportunity to build up that character allegiance thing that's going on. Because what they're doing in this is engaging you, and then I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but nobody makes it very long.
Yeah.
Nobody's making it to the end in this, but that's because that's the way this is constructed. We're going to bring you in and we're going to kill them off quick. That's what's going on.
And then we got a couple of animated series that could not be more different. The complete 2003 TV series and television movie of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Mm. This is the original series that basically started everything, and it's perfectly fine. it's perfectly fine. It's a certain kind of animation. I think it feels fresh in ways that the 27 other series that they have done since have not. The voice casting makes sense. So, you know, it's worth for nostalgia buffs. That's a good one to hang on to. And South Park seasons 21-25 in a box set. They're doing this now, apparently, 5 seasons at a time. Mm. I think it kind of makes sense. You know, you can. It's just this thing's been on the air for 2 decades. Nobody's going to know where to find the episode that they like. So. You know, might as well buy 5 seasons at a time and you know, throw it on, let it play out, put it on during parties, put it on during the day, just enjoy the jokes as they roll by. It's a smorgasbord of pop culture madness, and they somehow keep it going. Lots of commentaries and fun stuff. All right. We'll save the rest of the stuff for the next time. Strikes are still going on. I think I'm probably going to go join.
As of this taping, there were talks. Was that today or yesterday?
I guess that was yesterday. Who cares? I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. They're going to put it out next week. I mean, by the time this show is up, they'll be putting it out to the membership, and the membership will say no, and the strike will continue.
What do we have any word on? I know an offer was made.
They have not talked since May, and they've spent 3 months putting together this is my prediction. They put together 3 months worth of divide and conquer proposals. So they're trying to figure out what can we offer certain smaller constituencies of the Writers Guild that will peel them off, so that the guild will not be on strike anymore. They're going to try to peel out so that, you know, showrunners will give them a little something, and then these writers will give them a little something, and these writers will give them a little something, and that way everybody will feel like they're getting something, but they'll cave on the AI. They will cave on the pension fund and the residual and the data stuff. They're trying to divide and conquer. That's my prediction. I don't think it's going to work.
All right. Interesting. We'll talk about it next time. All right. Yeah, we'll see what happens then. Wow.
Awesome. All right, Tim, have a good week. We'll see everybody else next time.
Okay, brother.